We always talk about my father being radicalized twice. Once by what the Bauhaus stood for and his experience of it there. And the second, when he realized that this woman, Ethel Fodor, was a Jew and was in grave danger. That made him very angry about being a German. They were in the same cohort of students, and they had friends in common. I mean, they made friends in common. But more than that, I don't know. Even when I visited Dessau and one of the staff members found out who I was, he said, "Oh, my goodness me, if you're Ernst Mittag's son, we need to talk to you because we have very little information about him." As you know, that's still the case. My name is Michael Mittag. I am the younger son of Ethel and Ernst Mittag.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. I'm Anja, your host. Today's episode is not about just one Bauhaus person, but about two. It's the premiere of our first episode about a Bauhaus couple, Ethel and Ernst Mittag, who were both students at the Bauhaus in Dessau, met there, fell in love, got married, had children, and emigrated to South Africa when Ethel, as a Jew, was in great danger in Europe. But first things first. Ethel Mittag was born Ethel Fodor in Zagreb in 1905. When she was 9 years old, she moved to Budapest with her parents and loved to spend her summer holidays in Pécs at her family's summer house. After she had finished school, Ethel went to Vienna in Austria to study at the Graphische Lehr- und Versuchsanstalt, the Graphic Teaching and Research Institute, from 1925 to 28. Here she also helped the landlady's daughter in her photo studio and got in touch with photography for the first time. About her time at the Bauhaus from 1928 to 1930, Ethel later wrote in her autobiography, "This was a new world for me. Everything was completely different from what I knew. Nothing was taken for granted. Everything had to be discussed, examined anew from different angles. There was almost absolute freedom from prejudice. Of course, I was completely bewildered and intimidated." Ethel studied at the advertising department and then, when founded in 1929, at the photo class. She became prolific in it and could earn a living with it for some time. At a demonstration on the International Women's Day, Ethel met two rough-looking fellows, as she stated in her autobiography, who had arrived at the Bauhaus via the river Elbe, by boat. One of them was Ernst Mittag. He was from Riesa and had studied in Dresden before coming to the Bauhaus to study architecture and carpentry. The two of them became involved in the communist movement, holding clandestine political meetings in their kitchen in a workers' housing estate in Siebig, a suburb of Dessau, and publishing a communist paper in Berlin after leaving the Bauhaus. Even in South Africa, they felt most comfortable with the members of a left book club. While Ethel wrote her autobiography with the title "Not an Unusual Life for the Time and the Place" for her grandchildren in 1979, and it was published by the Bauhaus Archive a few years ago, and it is a superb read to empathize her different stages of life. Not much is known about Ernst Mittag, though. Until today. Because in this podcast, their younger son, Michael Mittag, tries to remember as much as possible about both of his parents by remembering conversations with them, by looking at all papers of them, and by talking about their work and projects. So, let's dive into the very first double episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Ethel and Ernst Mittag.
My mother was born December 28th. 1905. She was actually born in Zagreb because her father was posted there by the army. He was an electrical engineer and was part of a group of technicians who were designing a mobile command post for the Austro-Hungarian army, but eventually returned to Budapest, and she went to school in Budapest. In fact, she went to a Catholic school despite being a Jew, because my grandfather had converted to Catholicism in order to make progress, since he was a government official, fairly high up in the Post and Telegraph Department, And there was quite a lot of anti-Semitism in the, I guess, in the 1880s and before. So that is the reason he converted. So it was a bit strange for my mother to go to a Catholic school. but she did quite well there, and I think she enjoyed it. After school, she was always interested in art and graphics. And so she studied at a graphic institute, the name of which I don't have. But it was a graphic institute in Vienna. I think she was there for a couple of years. And at the end of that, returned to Hungary. And the story she told me and my brother is that a friend of her father's came to visit with his son, with whom my mother started to talk about their hopes and ambitions. And she told him that she was going to go to another graphic art institute, to which he responded, "No, you're crazy. There's no other place to go now but the Bauhaus. You must go to the Bauhaus." To make a long story short, she persuaded her parents, who weren't that keen, because I think they knew a bit already about the Bauhaus. But in the end, they agreed. And she went to the Bauhaus, I'm not sure of the exact year, probably 1928. And her intent was to study graphic art and photography. And I think she had quite a battle, because at that time, women students were sort of steered in the direction of weaving, but she didn't want to do that. And eventually she did manage to persuade them that she could study photography and graphic art. She is a very small but very tough, only 5'2" at that time. The other thing that she and her female co-students tried to fight for was that women could get a diploma as well, which they didn't succeed in. At that time, only men were awarded diplomas at the Bauhaus. No, women didn't receive them at that time, and it rankled with her. I don't know even if women got some kind of record of their study there. But nevertheless, that is where she met my father. They became close friends and eventually lovers. Eventually, they were married, but they weren't married in Dessau. They were married in 1930 in Berlin, by which time the Bauhaus had moved to Berlin. As you probably know, it's quite difficult to get information about what my father did. So there's not a lot that is in the archive. He was born in Riesa, April 4th, 1906. I think it's between Meissen and Dresden, a small town which I have visited once, a very conservative family. He would have been a good conscript for the German army because he wasn't Jewish. He was very keen on woodworking and boat building. He built himself a yacht in the backyard of his parents' house in Riesa. He did attend a yachting school, and I think he stayed and lived in or near Riesa until he went to the Bauhaus. When they were in the Bauhaus, of course, they were close. The joke they used to tell us is that since my mother was a night owl and my father was a day person, they only met for many weeks at a time. They only met in the shower, one of them showering before going to bed and one of them showering before going to work. But I don't know what persuaded my father or how he came to the decision to go to the Bauhaus, other than his interest in construction and design and woodworking and furniture design. Those are probably the reasons he chose to try. He also qualified as a cabinet maker, because I think if you wanted to be an architect at the time, you had also to be qualified in some other related to construction. It came in very useful later in life, because he built another yacht in his backyard in South Africa, and he did all the woodwork and everything inside, which is quite complicated in a yacht because nothing is straight. So it's all hand-fitted. He designed and made furniture for our house. One of them is a table that I still have here, which can be expanded by folding out the middle section. I think he should have applied for a design registration for that, because now one can see those things all over the place. The original table that was built in Cape Town, probably in 1947 or 1948, it is in our kitchen here. And so it's 70-some years old, I guess, and still used every day. And there was other furniture that he designed, sideboards and things like that, which I can remember in my childhood until I was in my 20s. They were part of our whatever home we were living in. His diploma is for, obviously, architecture. It was signed in October of 1932. It's very faded because I made a very high-quality scan of it, and then I gave the original to my brother. It's Bauhaus dieser Hochschule für Gestaltung. And then it just says, durch Beschluss der Konferenz vom 6. Oktober 1932 ist dem Studierenden Ernst Mittag als Beleg für das mit Erfolg abgeschlossene Stadium in der Bauhausabteilung dieses Bauhaus-Diplom zugang worden. And then it's signed by Nies van der Rohe on the 11th of October in 1932. And it's a typed, other than the actual printing, the rest is like typed with a typewriter. And my mother or my father also added a photograph of the Dessau Bauhaus buildings below it. Mm. It's my understanding that he designed a portion of a hospital somewhere in what is now the Czech Republic. I thought I might have had some information on it, but I've hunted and hunted. But that was his the work he did to qualify for his diploma, the practical. As I say, I couldn't find that from the people that I spoke to in Dessau, unfortunately. And then in Berlin, he went to work for quite a few different people. Fred Vorbart was one of them, but he also worked for a company called Standard Möbel in Kurfürstendamm somewhere. And I guess he was designing furniture there. Beosina Zementfabriks und was noch. He worked for another architect called Dietrich und Liebsch, and that was until 1937.
Let's have a closer look for a short moment at the different employers that Ernst Mittag worked for in Berlin during and after he had finished his studies at the Bauhaus. Fred Vorbart was a Jewish-Hungarian architect from Page. In the early years of the Bauhaus in Weimar, he taught there and worked with Walter Gropius on different projects. In his work reference from Vorbart, Ernst Mittag is described as having worked there for the past 2 years and as having played an active role in the construction of the Siemensstadt housing estate in Berlin-Haselhorst, in particular in the preparation of the detailed drawings and supervision of the execution. It is dated 15th of May 1931. Another work reference is dated November 1932, certifying Ernst Mittag's involvement in the project planning of a brick factory for the Beozina Zementfabrik AG for the past 4 months. In 1933, then, Mittag worked for Standard Möbel in Berlin, a company founded in 1926-27 by the Hungarian designers and architects Marcel Breuer and Kalman Lengyel to produce and sell tubular steel furniture. Breuer was then still young master of the Bauhaus carpentry, and while Gropius was counting on Breuer's clean and high-fashion furniture to become a bestseller for the Bauhaus GmbH, the Bauhaus company, Breuer went behind his back and planned otherwise. Standard Möbel was soon sold, including the manufacturing rights to the renowned furniture manufacturer Tonnet in 1929, and Breuer continued work with Tonnet. Lengyel, on the other hand, founded his own company called Standard Möbel Lengyel & Co. at Kurfürstendamm 205 in Berlin. This is the company that Ernst Mittag worked for from 1st of February until 31st of May 1933, as stated in his work reference. It also says that Mittag realized designs and furniture. From September 1935 until February of 1937, then, Ernst Mittag worked for the Berlin architectural office Dietrich und Liebsch. Here again, as in Fred Vorbart's office, Mittag was in charge of housing and settlement projects. According to my own research, Dietrich und Liebsch was, for example, responsible for a housing complex at Andernacher Straße and König-Winter-Straße in Berlin-Karlshorst, built in 1929 and today under monument protection. I haven't found any more buildings, though, which is probably due to the fact that over 11% of the housing was destroyed during World War II in Berlin, in some districts even over 50%. That's something that the broadcasting station RBB, Rundfunk Berlin-Brandenburg, researched and published on their website. I'll put the link in the show notes for you. All of Ernst Mittag's work references just mentioned are with Michael Mittag. Thank you so much for sending copies of them to me, Michael. As far as I know, Ernst Mittag's work during and after his time at the Bauhaus in Dessau and Berlin have never been published anyway before. So, This is the first time, and I will make sure this will make its way into Wikipedia too. Let's return to Michael's account of his parents for a while.
But I think they both were admirers of the whole, the concept of the Bauhaus was something that they were very impressed by and proud to be involved in it. My father's tutor was Mies van der Rohe, and also Hildesheim was another one. But that's how they related to their co-students and the masters, I think, very well. But she had lots of friends, like the Schwerins, and Lottie Rothschild was a good friend of hers. I'm going by memory here. And then in amongst the masters and her co-students, I think they were close to even the masters like Paul Klee and Kandinsky, Lux Feiniger's father, and others. So mm-hmm. I think it was a very intense and exciting time at the Bauhaus with those people with whom they were students and who taught them, and they socialized together a lot as well. They had other very close friends. Waldemar Adler was a very close friend, I guess a comrade in arms almost, of my father's. And Willy Jungmittag, who actually lived with them in Berlin because he didn't have a place to live or any income either. Fortunately, my mother received care packages from her parents in Hungary, which kept them all alive.
Before turning away from the Mittag's time at the Bauhaus, I would like to talk a little about Ettel's studies and work there. After studying in the preliminary course with Joseph Albers in 1928-29, Ettel was faced with the decision to choose one of the departments at the Bauhaus. Of course, it was mostly advised to women to go into weaving, but although Ettel was always interested in weaving itself, she was not interested in joining an all-women's class at all. So she chose the printing and advertising workshop, as she had already studied graphics in Vienna. Here, she was the only woman in the workshop, and once she had shown the master that she knew what she was doing, and when she obtained an order for a book design, she was allowed to do the tricky layouts. In 1929, finally, a photo class was set up, led by the Berlin photographer Walter Peter Hans. Ettel joined and now had a perfect combination of graphics and photography that was so in demand for all the illustrated papers that started popping up in the 1920s. Ettel's photos from her time at the photo class are deeply influenced by her teacher Peter Hans regarding the precision and perfection of the still life scenes and executed prints. There is the photo of seemingly arbitrarily placed ruffled curtain fabrics, but then you see the company's tag visibly placed right in the middle of the photo. This photo was the winner of a competition for Identränenfarben. You can see this photo and all the others that I will be talking about online. I will put links for you in the show notes. My favorite photo is the study of a toy pistol shooting three sugar cubes towards a glass filled with water and blank cartridge paper coming from the pistol in loops. All of this is shot from above and put into a diagonal, pointing from the right lower corner into the upper left corner. And then there are Ettel's portraits of friends. For me, they are on the next level compared to other photos by Bauhaus students. They radiate a calmness and create a universe of their own. One of the portraits is of Ricarda Schwerin, who, as a Jew, emigrated to Israel with her husband Heinz and was really good friends with the Mittags. Taken from below, Ettel captured Ricarda in a moment of introversion. She looks into the right lower corner of the photo, and a fluffy lock of her otherwise short haircut falls down in waves. You can also see parts of Ricarda Schwerin's top, jacket with flowers on it, with thin straps. Another portrait shows the Bauhaus student, later architect and fellow communist, Isaac Butko. The focus is on his boyish face with soft lips and his eyes absently gazing into the distance, into the upper right corner of the photo. His fashionable turtleneck shirt with a button and his coat are still visible. Once again, Ettel composed a portrait that shows a world of its own, capturing the beauty and pensiveness of a young Bauhausler. She took those photos with her own Rolleiflex 6x6 camera. She was fascinated by avant-garde photographers like André Kertész and her Bauhaus friend Lux Feininger, who painted their kitchen in Dessau with an underwater scene and a barrel with the word whiskey around the water tap. In her autobiography, Ettel Mittag wrote that she kept taking photographs after her studies at the Bauhaus and could earn a living from it. In Berlin, she took photos for election reports, among others, of the German left-wing politician Ernst Thälmann, and worked for the photo studio Foto Jacobi on Kurfürstendamm 216, run by the sisters Lotte and Ruth Jacobi. Especially Lotte was popular for her portrait photos of Käthe Kollwitz, Albert Einstein and Klaus and Erika Mann from the 1920s. Ettel also sold her photos to illustrated magazines. On a trip to Moscow, she took several photos, but they were confiscated and destroyed by the KGB because she had allegedly taken a photo of a secret building. When Ettel returned to Hungary, she earned money by taking children's portraits, landscape and social photos. Nearly all of her work was destroyed when Ernst and she had left their belongings in Riesa with Ernst's family. His sister-in-law had become a ravaging Nazi and had thrown their suitcases into the river. All of Ettel's photos and her equipment, everything was lost. After emigrating to South Africa, the first few years she worked as an architecture photographer. She soon gave up taking photos.
They didn't talk a lot about their time at the Bauhaus in Dessau, more in Berlin, where with a group of other like-minded left-wingers, they ran a small clandestine anti-Nazi newspaper. My mother did the graphics for that. But once the 1936 Olympics were over, my father said that, you know, you're a Jew, these guys are going to kill you. You must go back to Hungary and live with your parents. I will stay here. And eventually the police or the Gestapo, they found out about this newspaper and arrested all of them. So my father spent a few months in jail. One of the nice anecdotes, and my brother and I have seen it, is that they didn't have anything to do in jail. So they chewed on the bread that was given them each day. Sometimes they were given pumpernickel and sometimes brown bread. So they had two colors, black and brown, and they chewed it and formed it into chess pieces. I can remember seeing these chess pieces as a child. They brought them with them to South Africa. So, yeah, innovative ideas, but it's just an interesting anecdote. Oh, yeah, I mean, I can remember these very clearly, these chess pieces, because unfortunately, I don't know where they are now. You know, my brother and I have moved around quite a bit. So in the process, who knows, they might have been lost or mislaid, but I don't know for sure. Anyway, that's how they separated after the Olympics, 1936, 1937. My mother went to Hungary. My father stayed in Germany, in Berlin. But once he was out of prison, I think they decided they'd better emigrate. Probably, and it's probably the reason they didn't have a great opinion of Hannes Meyer. I know that from, just as you mentioned it, I can remember them making comments about him that, you know, he was not the best person as far as they were concerned, because he was willing to compromise with the authorities in things that he knew were wrong. But other than that, they didn't talk much about him. No, he didn't talk much about Misa, other than that he was his tutor. I think he felt that Mies was too much interested in his own self-promotion. One of the things he didn't like, and it's probably the reason we don't have too much information about him, because he didn't like people who pushed themselves to the forefront. I think that's one of the things he did not admire about Mies van der Rohe. He knew about Mies' success here in America. And in fact, on one of my parents' visits, I took them to see two buildings in Montreal that were designed by Mies. One was a petrol station, in fact, but very clearly identifiable as Mies' design. And the other was a commercial and apartment building in Montreal called Westmount Square. Very fancy place with Van der Rohe designed furniture in the lobby and so on. So they've seen his later work on their visits to Montreal. There were masters that I think they did admire. I'm sure Pieter Hans was one of them. Obviously, the founder, Walter Gropius, was very much admired by everybody. But other than that, no. My father stayed in Berlin, as I told you, after 1936 for a couple of years. But he went to Budapest whenever he had a chance to see my mother. And it's the reason my brother was actually born in Hungary, not somewhere else, not in Germany. And at that point, he and my mother decided they should go somewhere else. Germany wasn't going to be a place where my mother could live safely. He was already told by the Gestapo that they'll get him. Even though he was being released, they will get him one day. That's the story he related to us. That is an interesting story and a lucky one for me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. My mother's uncle, that is the brother of her father, had gone to South Africa in the 1880s. The story goes that he was actually qualified as a mining engineer, and his parents said, you know, it's time you get a job and stop just having a good time wandering around Europe on our money. And he did. He signed a contract with a Belgian company called Union Minière, and he was on his way. But on the boat, so the story goes, he met an Englishman who liked to play bridge and also liked his drinks. And this uncle of my mother's was a very good bridge player, and he could hold a lot of liquor without getting drunk. So they became friends. They played bridge together, and this Englishman said, you know, you're crazy going to the Congo and Katanga. It's just jungle and pygmies there. Well, and this uncle of my mother said, well, you know, I have a contract. And the Englishman finally persuaded him to not get off the boat in the Congo and continue on at least as far as Cape Town. I believe that he lent this is now my great uncle. He lent him some money. And that's how he arrived in South Africa. He was a very entrepreneurial man. His name was Theodore Felbert. He started various businesses in South Africa, a distillery and a blanket factory. And, you know, he did very well. He made quite a bit of money and became quite influential. He invested it in probably gold and diamond mines at that time. And so he was wealthy and influential. He is the person who arranged for my parents to go to South Africa, which was, you know, to my parents, Africa was an unknown quantity, the dark continent. So this Uncle Theodore arranged a passage for my father on a ship from Genoa to Cape Town in March, I believe, of 1938. You couldn't land in South Africa if you were considered indigent. So this great uncle of mine went aboard and put money into my father's pocket and said, when they ask you, you take out the money and you say you can support yourself, which is what happened. So he was accepted. He was able to disembark in Cape Town. This great uncle of my mother's, looked after him. Actually, the story goes, and this came out later, that Theodore Felbert said to my father, who was working as a draftsman for £15 a month, he said, anybody who came to this country when I did and is not a millionaire today must be very stupid. Why don't you get a job with one of these companies? And my father said, look, I'm an architect. That's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Even if it's only £15 a month, that's what I want to do. My mother and my brother came later by the same route, although I think they went from Budapest to Genoa by train. My father had walked most of the way from Berlin, also from Genoa to Cape Town, later in November of the same year, November of 1938. My brother was by then 18 months old. This is also a little anecdote, personal family one. The first word that my brother learned was zuppa, because this was an Italian boat. Zuppa was what he had. So they arrived in Cape Town in November of 38, I believe, and joined my father. Their first visit to a beach after both of them were in Cape Town was an interesting one, because when they came out of, they went to the beach and they went swimming, and when they came out of the water, there was a policeman standing by their clothes and towels. And he said, you know, you're subject to arrest. Man kann's nicht hier ganz nackt schwimmen. You have to wear a bathing suit. Why? Said my father, it gets all wet. So that was the first sort of experience of Puritanism in South Africa. They, in Germany and in Dessau, if they went for a swim in the Elbe or wherever, they never wore any clothes. I mean, during the war, he worked for an architect called Norman Lubinsky in Cape Town. And Norman Lubinsky had a reasonably sized sailing boat. And since there was no work, they went sailing together. instead of being architects. And I think Levinsky was quite generous. He nevertheless paid my father's salary, but my father was a skilled sailor, so he enjoyed that. Sailing instead of designing. My father continued to practice as an architect, as a solo practitioner, for his entire professional career in South Africa. He didn't want to employ people, although he had to from time to time when he had very large projects that he needed a draftsman. But normally he was on his own. And he practiced until he was probably 80, late 70s, early 80s. And he had one or two very important clients. In fact, one became crucial because it was, I don't know if in Germany, if you ever come across an apple juice called Appetizer. My father designed the first factory that made Appetizer because he was the architect for the owner of that farm and that business, a man called Edward Lombardi, who had very little formal education, but he had one outstanding skill, which is his ability to choose people who knew what they were doing. And he chose my father. E.J. Lombardi also had a ceramic refractories business. They made bricks, and my father did some design work for them too. But Appetizer factory was designed by my father. I think it was the first time in South Africa that glass fiber and epoxy was used for the entire inner lining of a building or a room, because Appetizer has to be made in a bacteria-free environment. So he decided to do it this way because you could avoid all sharp corners. Every corner was rounded. So it was very easy to keep clean, and it was subsequently expanded quite a lot. It was a very successful product for Appetizer. I don't know, not many people know that my father was the person who designed the factory. He was sent by E.J. Lombardi to Switzerland to study how these juices are made. There are no preservatives. It's just apple juice with some corrected trace elements that are necessary and slight aeration. That's the story. And it's a very refreshing drink, and that's all I will say about Appetizer. I used to drink a lot of it. He was a very versatile architect, I think, because apart from residential, you know, he designed houses for a few people. He designed all the buildings and all the houses for this farm, Appletwaite Farm, in about 40 miles from Cape Town. He designed a village, a small village for workers, a clinic, and a children's creche for the workers on this farm. And he designed a couple of houses, one for the son, and then the redesign and expansion of the original thatched roof old farmhouse that was there when Lombardi arrived in South Africa in 1930, I believe. He designed a printing press. He designed a candle factory, a doll factory. And later on, Mr. Lombardi became quite a devout Anglican man. He was very religious, and he wanted a church on his farm, and he asked my father to design it. And so he went to a retreat for priests for a couple of days and stayed there to figure out what do they do every day. And he designed a really lovely little church on Appetizer. I can remember as a child, the pastor was the retired bishop of St. Helena. The best story of all is that the church was consecrated by the Archbishop of Cape Town, at that point Archbishop Joost de Blank, who was opposed to the apartheid government. But at the consecration ceremony, Mr. Lombardi introduced my father as follows: "Your Grace, meet Ernst Mittag, the architect and atheist." So he had a sense of humor. I spent a lot of my childhood on that farm, because I went with my father sometimes, but I also became very friendly with the son of the owner. I went to nursery school with him, in fact. So in the early days, my father didn't get work always as an architect, but since he was knew how to survey, he got a job to survey a railway spur line to connect the main line to a large cement factory, among other things. He also designed furniture for some of his clients, not only the buildings. He didn't compromise much. He said to every client, "I will design, but I will also supervise." You know, supervision, you get paid a little extra. And if the client didn't like that idea, he said, "Well, find another architect." He was adamant about supervising his own designs. And he was adamant about quality building. I mean, there's some lovely anecdotes, one of which is he designed a house for an owner, one of the directors of a very large construction company, but this was for the owner. And it happened to have a curved brick facing of the chimney that stuck up above the roof line, and it was supposed to be part of a circle, but it had a flat spot. And I was with him, actually. He told the foreman, "You must rebuild that. That's not the way it's designed." And the guy refused. So my father said, "Look, even my 12-year-old or 9-year-old son can see it's not right." "No, it's fine," said the builder. He climbed up on the roof and he kicked it down. And it caused a terrible row with the owners of with the company that was doing the building. But he said, "Look, you asked me to design something. You build it the way I designed it. Otherwise, why ask me to do it?" He stuck to his principles throughout his life. And something that I've come to realize in later life was that he was at least 50 years ahead of his time when it came to conservation and the effects of capitalism on our environment. And he made sure that my brother and I would read The Silent Spring. I remember another book by Vance Packard called The Waste Makers, which was largely about the wastage that goes into packaging. So he made sure that we understood that you can't just consume, you must also conserve. Oh yeah, every day now when I think back, I realize how far ahead of his contemporaries he was. So yes, a little visionary in a way, but a visionary who kept his light under a bushel. No, he adapted to the South African topography and climate. I think some of the homes that he designed, you could see the Bauhaus influence. But among the things that he insisted, he always surveyed the building site himself. In other words, he drew the topography of the building site. In fact, my brother and I often had to hold the staff while he did the survey, looking through his theodolite and, you know, tramping through the bush up and down hills with the staff was our job. So he insisted on that. He wanted his buildings to fit into the landscape and not be stuck on top of the land. They must be integrated with the topography. Not exactly cubist, but very straight lines. Of course, in that part of the world, they must face north. Rather than in the northern hemisphere, you want to face south. And the house that he built for himself at our farm had this very long overhang on the north side, so that when the sun was low in the winter, you got sunlight, but when it was high in summer, it was shaded. He also used a reflective roofing material that you could see it shining if you were a few miles away on the top of Table Mountain, because, you know, it can get hot, so he wanted a heat reflected in summer. Yeah, he had his own style. Unless he was asked to renovate or rebuild an older building, which once again he was asked to do on the Appletizer farm. It was an old house, and one of the other anecdotes is that when he was asked to redesign it or rebuild it and modify it in a certain way, there was a refectory table inside the house, which had been built inside the house, and the owner wanted to keep it. And so they designed a whole structure that they built around this table to protect it in its original state and position while all the building went on around it. It's one of the things that he did, and I can remember as a child. Well, that is a sad state of affairs because, for whatever reason, my mother didn't preserve them. And I think since every design had to be submitted to the city for approval, that somewhere in the city's archive, we probably would be able to find, but we haven't figured out how, find these designs. But given the state of affairs of the South African administration at the moment, it might be quite difficult. You asked about whether he was involved with the communist cell in Dessau and later on in Berlin. The answer was yes, but when he arrived in South Africa, they very soon realized that they had jumped from frying pan back into the fire, as he put it, because Black South Africans were not even almost recognized as human beings. And it was a terrible shock for them. And the only opposition to the Nationalist Party was the South African Communist Party, in which they were both active. And they paid dearly for it. He wasn't allowed to leave South Africa for a period of at least a stretch of 16 years, he was never given permission to leave and return. It's Mr. Lombardi who persuaded their authorities to let him go to Switzerland to study appetizer process, but they were listed as communists under the Suppression of Communism Act of South Africa, which was a catch-all. They could declare anybody they didn't like. The consequences were sometimes you were restricted to live in the magisterial district that you lived in and not leave it. If you left it, you were arrested. And being listed was a deterrent in a way. Obviously, the South African Communist Party was also banned at that point, as were a few other organizations, one or two of which one in particular I worked for, which was the South African Defense and Aid Fund. But let's not talk about me. We're talking about my parents. My mother did work as a professional photographer. She did some architectural photography for a photography studio. During the war, the military, I guess, employed people who had foreign language skills because they they read all the correspondence that went between South Africa and its soldiers and others. And so she was the one who translated the Hungarian letters for the authorities. Mm. She did it because she needed a job. She said she didn't really like it because it was, looking into people's private business. But it was a job. And then I guess I showed up, and now she had two children to look after. So she didn't practice for very long as a professional photographer. She worked with Walter Stardecker, who had a photographic business, and she worked for him for a while. But other than that, until we got, we'll come to perhaps the most important thing about their lives in South Africa, at least as far as I'm concerned, which was in 1947, they bought a piece of land, maybe 14 acres of land, which was rough and ready. It had been overrun with an invasive tree from Australia called a wattle tree. A lot of my childhood weekends and their weekends were spent clearing and preparing this land to be a farm. My father worked at his architectural practice from Monday to Friday and worked on the farm Saturday and Sunday. So 7 days a week. We also worked on the farm, getting it ready. Eventually, it was a farm to grow grapes, but not for wine, grapes for eating, what's called table grapes. Before they planted all the vines and so on, they went to an agricultural college for a couple of weeks to learn viticulture, because they knew nothing about that. So farming was a whole new profession for them in a way. They were always ready to learn something new. There were some 8,000 vines which had to be grafted onto a rootstock that's resistant to certain diseases, which we all did together. 8,000 grafts and 8,000 plantings, and then later on 8,000 prunings every year. So it was work, but we loved it, and they loved it. And I'm certain they did it for my brother and me. I think they understood that in South Africa, at least, understanding the land, what is supported by the land and what the land supports was important. And it is certainly, I can't speak for my brother, but for myself, living on that farm from age 7 until maybe 20 or 21, even though it was very hard work from time to time, it's made me who I am. And I think it's the one thing that they were proudest of all the things that they did after emigrating to South Africa. As I said, it started in 1947. It made a huge difference to their lives. It didn't earn much money. Sometimes we worked for the whole year and made £1,000. In those days, it was still sterling, the currency in South Africa. But it was worth it. So that's the thing that you asked what they were most proud of. I think that is it. Well, my brother left South Africa in 1964, but he'd also wasn't available to help on the farm before that because he was married and had a child and was busy doing his doctorate, although I was still available. But when I decided that I was going to leave as well, and I left in 1967, they realized that they couldn't run the farm without us. It was already quite difficult without my brother, because I know for me, during the harvest, I worked from probably 6:30 or 7 in the morning until 1 or 2 at night, every night for a couple of months, because my brother wasn't there anymore. So I had to do some of the things that he did. But when they sold the farm, my mother reverted to her interest in weaving, because she had the time now to do it. And she set up a weaving studio in a house in Weinberg. And I think it had always been an interest of hers, but she wasn't a weaver of fabrics. She was a weaver of pictures. She got better and better at it. Finally, people started to see her work. She had a couple of solo exhibitions in Cape Town. She also taught weaving at a school for the disabled in Cape Town, which I think was very satisfying for her. But her weavings are now all over the world because she gave them to friends. And my brother and I have a few. I believe she did study a little either under Annie or Josef Albers, and was a great admirer of Annie Albers. So I think that may have been, certainly would have influenced her. Whether she reflected on it or not, I don't know, but I'm sure it had an influence on her actually doing it and, starting to become a weaver. And as I said, she developed a very fond following in South Africa. Well, the name won't mean anything new to you, but one was called the Frank Joubert Art Center, and the other one I can't remember. But yes, I'm pretty sure that she was strongly influenced by Albers. My parents, when they were in this around 70, my father had by then bought another sailboat in Cape Town, and they competed in the 1976 race from Cape Town to Rio. There were my mother, my father, and three younger crew members. My father got a master's certificate beforehand, so he could do both terrestrial and celestial navigation. And the trip to Rio took, I think, 26 days. A big adventure for two 70-year-olds.
In her autobiography, Ettelmittag Road, it is strange to think of those faraway days in Berlin, here under the hot African sun. As I write this, I am lying next to the sea. It is a beautiful autumn day. The air is crystal clear. One can see the mountains on the other side of the bay. The color of the water is unbelievable, ranging from turquoise to black-blue. I just had a marvelous swim. All this beauty made me forget the past, and for many years, I did not want to think about it. It all comes back to me now. And the following, about the tumultuous times in Europe in the 1930s and her escape to South Africa. I tried, but I could not live like this. By now, it was obvious that we could never live together in Germany. This was the year in which the Olympiade was held in Germany, 1936. The official slogan was to be polite to foreigners. Wearing a Hungarian badge, I could go now anywhere. I returned to Berlin and soon I knew I was pregnant. When I was in my 5th month pregnant, I went back to Hungary. I wanted to go to Pécs and live in the new house Ernst designed. I wanted the child to be born there. When the Mittags were finally together again, reality kicked in. They wouldn't hear from their families and friends during the war and were worried sick. Ettel wrote in her autobiography, "But behind all this was the reality of the war. Apart from the terrifying news of the German victories, I was completely cut off any news from my family and friends in Hungary. Only a few scanty messages through the Red Cross told me that they were still alive. As it turned out, I did not see my parents for 9 years. Once the war was over, things didn't get any easier for Ettel's parents. Once again, Uncle Theo, her father's brother, would come to the rescue and this time help Ettel's parents to emigrate to South Africa too. About this she wrote, "My parents wrote about their difficulties. Altogether life was very difficult in the chaotic conditions after the war. My brother decided to emigrate to England and later to Canada. There was nothing much left for my parents in Hungary. And so it was decided, after they lost the house in Pécs, which was requisitioned by the government, that my parents would come and join us here. My father was already over 70. He lost his pension and all of his life savings. He did not know the language and was entirely dependent on his brother. In the end, things turned out well, and his years here were happy ones. He fell asleep peacefully at the age of 92. About giving up the farm, Ethel Mittag-Leitner wrote in her autobiography, "When we had to give up the farm because it became too much of a burden, I felt that everything which made me happy was falling to pieces. The boys went away, my father died, reluctantly I had to change my way of life once again. There were compensations, travel at last to Greece, England, Germany, North and South America, to see relatives and old friends. My work at sheltered employment, which gave me an entirely new insight, and with it the creative joy of weaving. Sailing the Atlantic Ocean in a small boat, but never again did I feel so much alive and completely involved as in those years on the farm." The Mittags then bought a small block of flats in Weinberg and the cottage next door, which Ernst restored for them to live in. Ethel started weaving at the Jewish Sheltered Employment Center, and after their race to Rio in 1976 on a sailboat, at the Oasis Center. She now wanted to give back to the community.
Anything could be discussed with my parents, and so my friends and some of theirs all came to our farm, which was called Sweet Valley Vineyards, because they could talk to my parents about things they couldn't talk to their own parents about. Everything was open. They were both adventurous. My mother, she appeared to be soft, if you like, soft-hearted. She was soft-hearted in a way, but tough as nails. She had to live with three men, that's me, my brother, and my father, all competing with each other. She was often the peacemaker. She was willing to lay down the law and wasn't willing to be pushed around because she was the woman in the house. She was tough that way. You couldn't get away with things with her just because she was a woman. That didn't sit well with her in any way. And she was outspoken. In the final analysis, if she was really, really mad and not making headway with us, she had a very, very precise, well-aimed kick, which is not good for men. My father was a tough guy, very quick-tempered, but also forgot about it almost immediately. He would, you know, if I did something stupid, he might give me a clap in the head, but then forget about it a few minutes later. So he was quick to anger, but determined, very, very hardworking. I mean, he didn't spare himself at all, but kind and generous in another way. Quick to anger, but quick to forgive. Politically, unforgiving of right-wing politics.
Thank you, Michael. Once we started talking about your parents, you remembered more and more things about your father's work and those little anecdotes that make a podcast so lively. I hope I could do your mother justice by talking about her photographic work that I was fascinated by from the very first moment that I saw it over 10 years ago, and by reading parts of her autobiography, which, by the way, is a really good read. Once again, it is called Not an Unusual Life for the Time and the Place. And while Ethel and Ernst Mittag's life stories may not be unusual for the time and place they lived in, it sure is an unusual life for us today. Although they had to leave their home and families and friends, they seem to have lived a life full of happiness and love in South Africa too. And that's it for today. Please don't forget to rate Bauhaus Faces on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you are listening, and recommend it to fellow Bauhaus fans and researchers. Maybe also join me on Instagram at Bauhaus Faces and on my website bauhausfaces.com. And now there's nothing left to say but tune in to the next episode of Bauhaus Faces.